Welcome to Ruby for Java developers. So, a little explanation about me. I'm Michael Van Loon. I work at F5 Networks. I'm a principal developer there, but I think like most of you, I'm just a programmer. I'm not one of these gurus that are floating around here who I love to meet every one of these conferences. But I'm going to share some information I think that'll be really helpful. If you think that we're going to see some internals of STL or some really secret ingredients, I don't have those for you, sorry. But what I do really believe in is helping developers write better code. And in that vein, I like to present things that help people who are just maybe, you know, not familiar with some of the concepts that could make better code and can help them do better with what they're doing. So let's see if this clicker works. Check that out. All right. So, what are algorithms? It's pretty simple. An algorithm is a procedure for solving a problem. As of finding greatest common divisor in a finite number of steps that frequently involves repetition of an operation. We have that. Broadly, a step-by-step procedure for solving a problem or accomplishing some end, especially on a computer. We have that too. So we've got a good start. So what are STL algorithms? It's kind of funny because I told somebody once that I was doing this particular topic, and it was at a bar. It wasn't anything to do with computers, and the guy's like, "Oh, algorithm. All right, well, I got this problem here. Solve this." And I was like, "No. All right, let me start over." So, STL algorithms are a predefined set of solutions to specific problems that have already been coded up. They're provided for free. They come with your compiler. These things solve a lot of general purpose problems. All of the algorithms operate on sequences or containers, parts of containers. They're declarative in syntax. They help you write code without writing loops. But inside an algorithm, they're going to iterate just the same as if you were writing a loop. Sometimes they iterate over everything in a sequence. Sometimes they can stop short. Cool thing is they're designed by people who are very good at their particular field. The numeric stuff are designed by guys who know about numbers. Sort algorithm is a very good sort algorithm. It's not the fastest one in the world, but it's very fast and usually better than what we can do if we're not an expert in writing sort algorithms. So, what is a raw loop anyway? I think it's pretty simple. For loop, while loop, that sort of thing. There's usually explicit code in there. Often contains many lines of code. Should it? That's an open question. If you have a whole bunch of lines of code in there, maybe you should write a function and just call it from your loop. Or maybe you should not write a loop at all. One of the other things like this one is there may be a lot of side effects inside and out, outside of that loop. So, for instance, we've already got some variables outside the loop here. We've got our vector. By necessity, these have to be outside the loop because of the way we've written it. Maybe we've got this bool variable that, lets us know whether something was in there or not. And we've even got a global. Well, that's not good. But the thing is that this, it can have side effects that might cause problems. So why would you use algorithms? Well, often, as I alluded to earlier, the code can be more efficient than a handwritten loop because not only do you have the fact that these things are written by people, they're well debugged. By people who know what they're doing with that particular domain. But because an algorithm is an internal part of the STL, as are the containers, It might be able to leverage internals of those containers and do things that you can't always do. And there are actually some algorithms that do run faster than if you were to write the same thing with explicit code, because they are able to leverage the internals of the containers. But in addition to that, they're cleaner and they're more clearly abstracted. The side effects are contained within the algorithm, within a clear interface, prevent the accidental leakage of side effects out of the algorithm. So it eases reasoning about the functionality of your code, the code inside the loop, the code outside the loop. And so these are good things, because we like having code that is easier to work with. It means less bugs. So what do we have in the STL? So there are five main sections in the C++ standard for the algorithms. I won't read everything off the slide for you, but we have our non-modifying sequence operations. We have mutating sequence operations, which are actually opposite, even though those are different words. Sorting and related operations, the general C ones we won't talk about, and then we'll have a few of the numerics in there as well. The non-modifying sequence operations do not modify the input sequence. Makes sense. They do not emit a result sequence. They're intended to not cause side effects in most cases. That's not always true, but the algorithm itself will not cause a side effect in the input sequence. The function object, if there is one, may cause a side effect. So, you know, for each, for instance, may modify things in the sequence as it's running, but the algorithm itself will not. Here are the non-modifying sequence operations. We have several. There's some really cool ones. We're going to go over some of these. And as far as the mutating sequence operations, these do not modify the input sequence, except when the input and the output sequences overlap. You may do in-place modifications, like with transform. In other cases, we may be emitting an output sequence explicitly. I won't go through all this stuff, but this is good reference material. The algorithm will cause an explicit side effect in the output sequence. The function object should not, because the algorithm itself is doing that. Here are some mutating sequence operations. There's some really cool stuff here, and we're going to go over it, because some of this stuff is really kind of interesting, what kinds of things you can do with these things. Sorting and related operations. It's a mix of modifying and non-modifying operations. Once again, we won't go through all of these. Default operation function for comparison is operator less. You can supply your own with most of these, and we'll do that. Some of the sorting and related operations, obviously sorts, binary search, there's nth element. We got merges, we got some set operations, union, intersection, difference. The min-max stuff falls under there. Stuff for doing your own heap. And this is kind of interesting. So these heap things here, you could use a heap container that does heap things for you, or you can use just a simple container and do heap operations this way. And the trade-off could be, you know, with a heap container, you might not know, you might not have the smarts to know if you're that container, whether something needs to be sorted every time it's touched or not. Sorting is kind of expensive. So what if you knew that you only needed to sort under really certain conditions, and that, you know, there are other times when you could do things with the container that didn't require sorting? Like, for instance, a set, you know, every time you do an insert, it does an ordered insert. With the heap operations, you can do for instance, the push heap, pop heap, make heap stuff without necessarily having to do more expensive operations. We'll touch some more of these things here. General numeric operations. There's a really cool little section here from the standard that's actually readable, that describes what they are. And these are the numeric operations that we have. So, C library algorithms, not a whole lot to talk about there. B search, Q sort. We're not going to do anything with those because this is a C++ conference. All right. So, for each and transform, these are your go-to generic algorithms for doing general things. They apply an operation to each element in sequence, in order. They will visit every single element that's in your range. They're very similar, except they're completely different. For each applies an operation to each element, just like I said. It's a non-modifying sequence operation. All of these other things apply. The function object may produce side effects if you have non-const iterators. For each is considered non-modifying because it does not itself modify the range. Transform, on the other hand, is a mutating sequence operation. The function object that you supply should not modify the input sequence or the output sequence because the transform operation itself does. We'll see some examples. So, a for each example, let's see some code finally. Let's generate a single hash for all strings in a vector. And so this would be, say, a vector of strings, and we want a single hash that represents that entirety of strings. How might we do that? So let's say we write a little functor sort of thing here where we're going to call it hash string, and we have the operator, the overloaded operator for making it a functor, and we're going to put something, I went too fast. It turns out we have another algorithm in there too. This is one of our numerics, accumulate. What I'm going to do is inside here, so this gets called for every string in the vector, and it's going to get passed a string right there. And inside that string, what I want to do is use accumulate to calculate a hash for that string. Accumulate is an algorithm that's a non-modifying, a numeric operation. It does not produce a side effect itself, but what it does is it calls a function object on each of the items in the thing, which returns a value, and that value is carried from element to element and then returned at the end. And so what we're going to do is use this accumulate. We're going to provide it an initial value of 0 for our hash. We're going to pass that 0 in as our initial value. And we're going to call this function hashChar to hash that particular char. We'll get back to that later. But how are we going to use it? So we're going to use our for each here. This is the thing we came here for. So here's our for each. We're going to pass it our vector of strings, begin and end. We're going to use our hash string thing up here that we created. And we're going to get a copy of that back out. So our hasher is an instance of this. And this is moved out of here at the end. It gets moved from element to element to element, being applied to each one as a string. And at the end, we get it back out. And a test of that might look something like this. So let's say we have a vector of strings here. We're going to tell it to hash all strings. And we're going to get a hash out at the end. And it might look something like this. Pretty simple. What's going to happen is this vector is going to get visited right here for each of these. The hasher is going to get called for each one. It's going to accumulate the hash. And at the end, we're going to get out a total that is for all of the strings in the vector. Here's just, if you're curious, some extra code. So here's the hash char function. And it uses this rotate left thing right here to do a character hash. What about if we wanted to do a hash for each string in the vector? We might want to use transform for that instead, because in this case, we're going to, we could modify stuff in place with a transform, but in this case, our inputs and our outputs are different types, because we're going to have a vector of strings, and we're going to want to output a vector of ints. So our hash string little utility thing here where we use accumulate has changed slightly. I've just turned it into a regular old function. And there we go. And how we would use it is something like this. So here's our transform. We've got a vector of ints that we've declared here for our results. We're passing in a vector of strings, begin and end. We're using a back inserter to stick our results into our output vector. And we're going to call a hash string on each one. And all this thing is doing is transforming. It's visiting each individual element. It's calling hash string on each of those elements, which returns the output here, UNT32. And transform is sticking that into our result vector. And it might look something like this. So here are some strings. Here's our hash each string, because we've turned it into a nice little convenience method. And we'll get some output. So any of, all of, none of. These are algorithms that apply a function object to a sequence, like many of our other algorithms. But of course, as the names imply, they determine whether any, all, or none of the elements in the sequence meet a condition. Because these have that behavior, they may not visit everything in the sequence, which is kind of nice. For example, if any of determines that you're visiting through and you're saying any of and a condition is not met, you know, it might exit early. Or all of, if it says all and it determines that one of them is not, it might exit early, right? Same with none. So that could be an optimization that you might need in certain conditions. Let's say that we want to take and validate some HTTP headers. We have a regex that determines a valid HTTP header. We could do something like this. We could take a vector of strings, which are headers, and we just say return whether all of the headers meet this regex. And we just use a little lambda here to do a regex match on the header being passed in, and then our matches variable and a regular expression we've determined or declared up above. And pretty simple. It just applies all of. If any of those don't match, then, for example, here's some test code. There's a bunch here. So this one matches, value true. This one, there's a space between the first thing and the colon, which is not allowed. So that's false. There's something wrong up here, false. And there's something wrong in here. I don't remember what it is, but these are all false. So you can look through that later if you'd like. I don't remember what I did on all of those that don't match, but for some reason they don't match. What about if we wanted to search the headers for something? We could use any of. We could find out if any of the headers meet some search criteria. Well, this is pretty easy too. We just do something like this, where we return any of, and our headers, once again, are strings. We've declared a convenience function where we have a find header and a find value that we're gonna try to match, and we just pass those right through to our lambda here, our find header and our find value. And so we construct a little regex inside, and we just do a regex match, and we do any of. And now if any of these headers match this regex, it will return true. And so we've got some stuff here. So let's say I'm doing I've got some headers up here, and I want to say header search, and there's my header string, and X superpower is toe strength. And you can see that I have one up here that is, I've got one up here that's not, got one here that is. They have other things in there as well, but we have true, false, and true. It seems to work. But we could get even fancier than that. What if we wanted to do some really cool stuff like we want to parse through all of these HTTP headers. We want to count the number of headers that are good, the number of headers that are bad, and we want a set or a multi-map here in this case of headers that match that search condition. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to declare a little struct here that contains all that information. I put a little convenience method on here to determine whether it's valid or not based on whether there are any bad headers and if there are at least one good header. And then this guy here is what we're going to use to process our information, the same as we did before. So he's just going to do that same regex search. If it matches the header regex, we're going to increment good headers. Then we're going to match it against the find values, and if it matches those, we are going to put it into our found headers multimap. If it doesn't match, we increment our bad headers. And so here's just a synopsis of that class without code removed. And we just call it something like this. So we've got a string of headers coming in. We have our find header and our find value. We declare an HD thing. We set our find values, and then I call headers begin, headers end, and we pass in the HD. The functor part of it does the comparisons on each of the strings, and we return, because this is how for each works, a moved copy of the final state of the HD thing at the end that comes back out the other side. And this really hard to read code are a few tests. So somewhere in here, so for each, HD founders begin, HD founders end. Okay, so I'm doing some output here. Where's my, it's hard to read looking up from this direction, but up there, so we're calling this function. There it is, header parse, H1. We're looking for that thing again. And in this case, we're gonna get, we got four good headers, zero bad, and we found our string. Here we have four good headers, zero bad, but we didn't find the string. Here we've got a bad header, but we did find the string. And it's all done with that for each. Just this call right here. All right. Let's do something different. Adjacent find searches for things in a sequence that are next to each other that meet a condition. By default, that condition is equality. We can provide our own condition. So, how about if we do something like create our own is sorted implementation? There already is one, so you don't really need this, but it's a cool little experiment. And when we do this, what we end up with is basically we use an adjacent find, begin, end, and we use the greater operator. And what that tells us is if any subsequent item is, because it's greater, we're saying if item n is greater than item n plus 1, return it. If that were the case, it would not be sorted. So we run this adjacent find, v begin, v end, greater. If the iterator gets to the end, the vector is sorted, else the vector is not sorted, and here's where it's not. So output might look something like this. Pretty easy. Adjacent find, it's one line, there you go. But what if we want to do something cooler, like, for instance, test for sequence deviation? So let's say we have a sequence of numbers, and they all vary from each other by a certain amount, going up and going down. But we want to make sure that those numbers don't change by more than a certain percentage, for instance. Might do something like this. We just use an adjacent find, or beginning or end. We have a little lambda here that has an allowed deviation, which we've passed in as a variable. And the allowed deviation we apply inside this lambda, we say, so whatever number is coming in, we multiply it by the allowed deviation, and we make sure that the change is not more, it doesn't get bigger by more than that amount or smaller by more than that amount. And we just do this with the adjacent find. I'm clicking, here we go, all right. A test might look something like this. So we do this check deviation with a vector. Here are some numbers. These are all within deviation. This is 10%, by the way. So we're saying make sure these numbers don't change by more than 10%. The vector is within the deviation limits. That's what's happening here. So let's push a 2.0 onto the back. 2.0 is more than 10% bigger than 1.2. All of a sudden, it's climbing through our vector here, and it says that we're outside the deviation limits between with values 1.2 to 2 at position 7. All that with an adjacent find. So what about something like removing things? Now, the scenario is you want to erase several items from a container that meet a condition. You could just also do this with a matching of value, but that's easier, so we'll do it this way. You could write a loop. That loop could do some checks. It could do some explicit special casing. It could deal with potential iterator invalidation. These are all things that are kind of a pain. Or we could do something like this. By the way, this dovetails with Scott Meyer's effective STL items 9 and 32. Might do something like this. Say we have a struct. It has a bunch of stuff in it, but one of the things is an expired flag. So we've got all this data in our data structure, and one of the things in here is sometimes it expires. We want to remove all the expired things. So we have a vector of these things. All I've got to do is say remove if v begin, v end, lambda that says return foo expired, and then erase it. No special casing, no loop, no extra code, super easy. All the things that are expired are now gone. And output, you know, before you might see something like this, after all of my expired false, are all gone. The trues are missing. Pretty easy stuff. Well, it's easy with an algorithm. All right. Now, this is kind of cool. So Scott Myers, he knows a lot of things, I found, reading his books. And this is a particularly interesting part. Knowing your sorts and your sort of sorts. The sorts being sort, stable sort, partial sort copy. These are all algorithms in the STL. The sort of sorts being nth element, partition, partition copy, stable partition. My footnote here indicates, as Scott does in his book, that these two will operate on bidirectional operators, which means that you can use them on lists. The rest of them require random access iterators, so they're going to work on vectors and that sort of thing, but not things like lists. All right, so know your sorts. Here's some information about these sorts. So sort is, of course, the most general operation that we have. It may, in some cases, be more efficient than stable sort because it can reorder equivalent items as it sees fit. Stable sort does not. It does a sort, but it preserves the order of things that are considered equivalent according to its sort criteria. Partial sort allows you to take a sequence and sort it into a smaller subset. We'll see how that works in just a minute. It's pretty cool. Partial sort copy will do a partial sort but put it into a new container for you. So sort and stable sort. Little example here. Say you have this situation where you have a data structure. It's got first, middle, and last names in it. And you need to sort this thing with precedence. Of course, last name being first, most important, first name being second, and middle being least. How would you do that? It might look something like this. Say here is some person data. We've got some people. They have names. This is good. The way you might start this is sort by the least influential data first. So what we're going to do is we're going to write a sort. Begin and end, a little lambda here that returns whether A middle is less than B middle. Pretty simple stuff. This sort is just going to sort. It doesn't care about the previous order of anything. It's okay because that's our first sort. But once we've done this sort, we want to preserve the relative order of the things we've already done. So the next thing we're going to do is a stable sort. We're going to do the same data begin and end here, but now we're going to sort by the first name, A first less than B first. And then finally, we're going to do another stable sort on the last name. Our most influential data comes last, obviously. Because these are both stable sorts, it means that the previous order of things that are the same will be preserved. And it's going to look something like this. Before we started, we had this data that was unsorted completely. And then we decided that we're going to sort by the middle initial first. And so we end up with these middle initials all in order. You'll notice that there's two here that have the same middle initial. These could be in either order because it doesn't really care about the pieces that we didn't look at. Next, we did our stable sort by the first name. And you'll notice that, of course, now the first names are sorted. But since it's a stable sort, you'll notice that the middle initials are still in the correct order. And then finally, we did our stable sort on last name. You'll notice that we had some matches here. But just like before, Jane, Joe, Jojo, Sarah, these are all in preserved order. And within those sets, our order has still been preserved. So pretty cool little way to get all that data in there. And it was only three lines of code. Partial sort, what the heck does that do? It's kind of a bit more interesting than you might think just going in. But it takes an input sequence of sort candidates, and it sorts those in the top n elements into a potentially smaller output sequence. Now, the order of items from the input sequence that are outside the range of the output sort are in any order. We don't determine those. It's an in-place operation. The partial sort copy, as I said earlier, will put it into a new place. Obviously, partial sort is more efficient than sorting everything in the container because you're sorting a much smaller amount of data. So, let's see an example. Let's say that we had some data. Data's good. Do a partial sort. And what this is saying right here is what we're going to sort and how we're going to sort it. So, the first part here, we're saying we're going to sort our range from the beginning to the beginning plus 8. So this is all of the potential data for sorting. But we're not going to sort all of that data because we're going to tell it that we only want the top 5. We're going to consider the top 8, but only sort the top 5. And we're going to, and this consensus is in place, they'll go in the first 5 positions. And my extra artistic drawing here kind of illustrates where those are going to go. And it would look something like this. So, we have 10 elements. We told it to sort from the first 8, so 57 and 99 are ignored. And we told it that we want the top 5 to be sorted. So, as you can see, within the top 8, and by the way, we used operator greater, so these are actually sorted in reverse order, you can see that 89, 78, 63, 42, 34 are in fact the top 5. 17, 22, and 12 are below them, but because these are outside the sort range, they're not in sorted order, which is exactly what we would expect. But they were considered in the sense that they are now omitted from the top 5. So, knowing your sort of sorts, partition, stable partition, partition copy. These are pretty cool algorithms. What do they do? Partition reorders the elements in your sequence such that all of the elements from your partition forward to the beginning are less than some condition, or they meet some condition as being true, and then all of the elements after that partition are not true. Stable partition preserves the order of things that are equivalent, whereas partition does not, just kind of like sort and stable sort. Partition copy will put them in a new container rather than doing them in place. So, what does nth element do? It reorders sequences such that all things before the nth position are less and all items after nth are not less. The order of the items is indeterminate, except that we know that they're either less or greater. But the item at nth is exactly the item that would be at that position if the sequence was fully sorted. What's the difference between these two? Partition partitions a sequence based on a condition. Nth element partitions a sequence based on a position. The partition point in partition is not guaranteed to be the thing that would be there in a fully sorted sequence, but it is guaranteed to meet the condition. Example. Example code is good. So, say we have a vector that looks something like this. We've got some data up here, and we're going to partition it. Here's our begin and end. And we're going to say we want all items that are less than 50 to be at the front of our partition, and all items that are not less than 50 to be after our partition. So we're going to end up with all of these items partitioned at the front, and all of the not square items partitioned after. And it'll look something like this. So here's all of our data. Notice it's not sorted, so this is more efficient than a sort. And the partition point that it ends up with after the partitioning is done is returned to us, so we know where that partition is. And what about partition copy? Well, it's almost exactly the same thing, except, so we're going to use begin end, we're going to use a back inserter for our smaller container and a back inserter for our larger container, smaller being smaller than 50, larger being 50 and larger. It looks almost exactly the same, except now we have two new containers rather than doing it in place. So let's mix these up and actually use them for something. What about if we wanted to take our prior person struct that we had and turn it into an employee struct? And what we want to do first is we want to partition management and individual contributors into two separate containers, because we might do something special with management and we might do something special with the individuals. After that, we're going to partition the management into executives and managers, and then we're going to partition our architects before our individuals, other individuals, and we're going to then stable partition, because we want to preserve that, our senior and junior people. So, first of all, let's define what our data looks like. So we've got this struct defined from descended from our person. So we still have our first, middle, and last that we had before. We also have an enum here for executive, manager, architect, senior, junior. Management is defined as manager and higher. Individual is defined as architect and lower. Or I guess it would be the other way around if we're talking numerically. And so that's our enum there. And here's some data. So we have some names and we have some positions. Let's take first and create that management and individual partitions. Actually, these are going to be separate containers here. So we've got a vector with employee data, one for management, one for individuals. We have incoming. So V is some incoming vector that contains everybody in completely random order. It's this thing we defined right here. So we're going to do our partition, copy, V begin, V end, back inserter into management. These are all the things that are true. True being defined as type is less than or equal to manager. And then we also have back inserter for individuals, which is false, which is going to be greater than manager numerically, which is architect, senior, junior. So now, as a result of this partition copy, we have two new vectors containing that data, but they're still in random order, right? So now, executives in the company get the company jet, managers get the company car. So what we're going to do is partition our management begin end, and we're going to say return the type is equal to executive. And so that's going to put the executives at the front partition and everything that's not executive after that partition. It's going to return us an iterator at the partition point. We know where this starts is where the managers start. So we know everybody from car it to end is eligible for the company car. The jet people start at management begin. So jet it to car it is all the people who can use the company jet. And then the next thing we want to do is take our architects, because they get to use the company segue, and partition those people out. So we have our individuals now, and we're going to say partition these people based on whether they're equal to architect. So those will be at the front of our container, and we'll get an iterator back that points to the partition point, because the people who are not architects will get to use the company bike. And so the segue people start at individuals.begin and go to the bike iterator. And bike iterator to end, of course, will be the people who get the company bike. Now, this partitions our individuals vector with architects at the front and everybody in random order afterwards. But the thing is, we have an old bike and a new bike. So we're going to take and stable partition. So we preserve the previous ordering. Anybody who is of type senior or better. And we're going to do the same vector. We're going to return an old bike iterator, because that's the partition point between senior and junior. And that'll help us to determine who gets to ride what. And the output of all of those things, just saw we had some output code in there, looks something like this. So that first partition gave us the management set, and then it allowed us to partition the people who use the company jet, the executives, the managers, company car. Now the second set of operations we did gave us the individuals partitioned with the architects up front, but the other people were still unpartitioned. So junior and senior are mixed. And then finally, we partitioned the people who were not architects so that the seniors were up front. Now, we didn't sort any of this stuff. None of this is sorted, but it meets the partitioning criteria so that we're basically pushing things to the front of our container as they meet certain conditions. It's much faster than a sort. It gives us the information we need because we don't care about the order. We just care that they meet a condition. So what about nth element? What the heck does that do? It's also a partitioning operation, but instead of being based on a condition, it's based on a position. A couple of really common ways to use it are to find, say, the median value in a set. And the median value would be the middle value. So you might do something like determine that your nth is size divided by 2, so it's the middle. Say nth element, v begin, vn plus nth. Sorry, v begin plus nth to end. And what will end up happening is you will get the thing that is actually the middle of the set. As a side effect, it will also be ordered, partitioned, so that everything that would come before that is in fact before that numerically. Everything that would come after that is, in fact, after that numerically. They're not sorted, but they are in the proper partitions. You could do the same thing, find the 75th percentile. So we'll just take size time percentile divided by 100, get our 75th percentile. And in fact, there it is right there. And once again, this number is exactly the number that would be there should it be sorted, but the rest of it's not sorted. It's just partitioned. So it's nice and efficient. This is an interesting question. Coming back to our partial sort, if you remember partial sort, it will take and consider a wide sequence of things and then sort a subset of those. You could do the exact same thing with an nth element plus a sort on a smaller set. So let's say we wanted to find the top 20 web pages on our website. Out of thousands of pages. We have a large number of pages, but we only care about the top 20. We want the top 20 elements of the sequence in order, and we don't care about the rest. So the requirement is the top 20 should be positioned to the front and the top 20 must be sorted, and we don't care what happens to the rest of them. Here are your two options. Partial sort, just like we used before, from begin to end, and our midpoint is begin plus 20, because we just want the top 20, right? Because we're sorting the top web pages, we're going to do an inverse sort, so greatest to smallest. Or we could do the exact same thing with an nth element, begin, end, begin plus 20, greater, and then sort from begin to begin plus 20, because we know now after this that it's partitioned, so the top 20 are at the top. And so we can apply the sort just to a subset. Are they equivalent? That's a good question. We could test, we could find out. So we could do a partial sort with basically the same signature we just saw. We could do the nth element with the same signature we just saw combined with a sort. We could use another algorithm. Look at this. Got another algorithm in there. Equal allows us to compare a sequence. Now, containers themselves have equality comparison operations on them, but that requires you to compare the entire container. Here, we don't want to compare the entire container. We just want to compare the top 20 items and all the items after the top 20, because we want to find out if the top 20 items are equal between these two things, and just because we're curious whether the things after that are. It turns out that the sorted portion of the vectors are equal. This is true because the partial sort and the sort with the nth element return the same sorted data. It's also interesting that the data after the top 20 are not in the same order. That's just information. It's kind of what you'd expect because they're different algorithms. It doesn't matter. We don't care about that data. As a side effect, it's interesting to note that there have been scenarios in the past, because these things are dependent on the implementers of your particular library, on your particular platform, your particular compiler. Years ago, there were circumstances where the nth element plus sort was actually faster than the partial sort for some reason. I don't know why. It just turned out that way. But because the modern ones that I've used anyway seem to be well implemented, and you'd expect a single operation that does the same thing as two would potentially be able to be optimized better. In fact, it is on GCC and Clang. It's 40 to 50% roughly faster doing it the partial sort way versus the nth element plus sort way. They're both faster than doing a full sort, but using the one liner instead of the two lines is a bit more efficient. So what is a rotate? Because we're skipping from topic to topic. A rotate moves elements specified in a source range to a destination position while moving the displaced items to the source position. It's a simple way to move one or more elements from one position in a container to another without using an erase and insert. Technically, it's a left rotate, but who cares? It just rotates. It moves the elements in place. Rotate copy does the same thing, of course, except it copies the elements to a separate sequence. It requires that first is less than or equal to middle, which is less than or equal to last. Is that a commentary on the... I'm being one-upped here. So a naive attempt at doing something that you could do with a rotate might look something like this. Say you have a vector with some data in it, and you want to move the two to this position here. So what you might do is you might go get your iterator to the two. You might get its value and save it in a temporary variable, and you might erase it. And then you might get an iterator to where you want to stick it, which is at position 6 minus 1, because we just deleted something, and then insert it again. And your output would look something like this. You'd go from this ordered sequence to 0, 1, 3, 4, 5, 2, 6. But that's not a good way to do it, because we can do it. Whoops. We can do it like, I think my pointer needs new batteries. All right, so erase, insert. Okay, so this is what's happening here. So we're taking this 2, sticking it over here, taking these and put them in here. But instead, what we could do is get our iterator to what it is we want to move and where we want to move it. We want to stick it right here before the 6, because that's how iterators work. And we just tell it to rotate. IT plus 1, because we're just taking this one element and stick it at IT2. And then it takes and swaps those things. We could do the same thing with you know, ranges that are bigger than one element too. We could take the IT to IT plus 3, which is these 3 items, rotate them into here, and of course these 2 items are going to rotate over here. And you can see that's what it looks like. So GCC's definition is, I think, another cool way to understand it, because when I was trying to understand what all of the intricacies of rotate were, this was actually kind of helpful. It's actually in the header for the definition of the function. Rotates the elements of the range first to last by middle minus first positions, so whatever the, you know, that much is, so that the element at middle is moved to first, and the element at middle plus one is moved to first plus one, and so on for each element in the range. This effectively swaps the ranges first to middle and middle to last. What if we wanted to do something? Sounds like we're changing topics, but we're not. Like this. Say you have some GUI, and this is Sean Parent. If you've seen Sean Parent's C++ seasonings talk, you've seen this. But it dovetails really nicely with all of this stuff, so I'm representing it. You can see his name is prominently displayed, so I'm not stealing this. What if you wanted to implement something that would allow you to move a range from one place to another in a list? Now, this could be like a GUI sort of thing, where maybe you have a list in a GUI, and you want to take these 4 items, and you want to stick them somewhere else, like, say, first to last is our designator, and we want to stick them down here. It would look something like that. And then we get a result back of where that starts. So R to P is now where the data's been moved. Or you might go the other direction. You might have your first to last right here, and you want to stick it up over here where this P is. The thing is, with rotate, you have to pay attention to the ordering of your iterators. And it's not set up the same way. It's first, middle, last with rotate. And here we're saying we want to declare first and last to be our source data, and then a point where the data is going to go. So Sean describes this as something called slide. And you could implement it like this. And what it's going to take is rotate this data down here, or rotate this data up here. And it's just implemented as one of 2 different rotates based on the ordering of the parameters. If P is less than F, which is this scenario here, the point we're going to put it in is less than our starting position, we take and rotate from PFL. And the side effect is we return the position that we've put it into, which is P right here, to R, the returned rotate position. Or we do it the other way, depending on if it's going the other direction. And that's all there is to it. We've just moved that data with a small number of lines of code. Very cool stuff. However, this is the cool one. And if you've seen Sean's talk, this is very anticlimactic. But if you haven't, imagine you had a UI or something like this, where you had a diverse set of things that were scattered about in this list, and you wanted to take all of those things and just move them to that point. So this might be, for instance, you multi-selected several different things, then you just want to pick them up and drop them somewhere. Any idea how you would do that?
So it's, I always forget,
Very close, and you've got the right concepts. But, and I asked that question without clicking through my animations first. But keep that in mind. So we're going to take these things and we're going to move them there. Think about that. Maybe break it into two pieces. So we're going to take that. Let's break our problem into two pieces. So you're right. We're going to take some things and we're going to take these diverse things and we're going to move them to a certain position. And what algorithm can take those things and do that? It's not rotate, but it looks a lot like a partition. Yeah, it's the same concept though. So what might that code look like? It would be something just like this. And Sean calls this gather. So here's the gather method. We're provided, so here, of course, we have our all of our individual things and our partition point, and then we want to return the resultant position. So we have our first and our last for our entire range, our partition point. We break those into, here's our first and our last for that, and then we get back the partition point from partitioning, and then the return from each of those two partitions gives us the range of the moved items. So it looks like this. So stable partition from first to P, not one, because we want the things that we've selected to be at the end, not the beginning. So this partition takes everything that's not selected, puts it up at the beginning, leaves our two things at the end. We have a second stable partition that takes the things from P to L and says, checks if they're selected, puts them at the beginning of this range, and then stick it all back together, and we have all of our stuff moved to where we want it. Two lines of code. Sean says that he developed this with Marshall Clough. It's in Boost. So you can actually use it without writing it, but there's the code if you need to. It's pretty small. We're almost out of time, so I'm going to zip through this pretty quickly. Set difference, this is pretty cool. So let's say you wanted to process some configuration. You've got some configuration stored in some sort of ordered container in your application, and you regularly receive updates to this configuration. So what you want to do is quickly be able to determine what's changed, what's new, what's been removed, and act on that. Well, you could write something like this. So let's say, for the sake of this example, we have a vector of strings that are going, so our configuration in this case is strings, but they'd probably be objects in your world. So you have an ordered set coming in that's our current configuration. We have an ordered set that's been provided by our updater, that's the updated configuration, and we're going to take the items that have been added and the items that have been removed and find them using set difference. So we're going to take the current configuration, beginning and end, the update, beginning to end, and this is going to tell us what things are in current that are not in update and store them in this removed items vector. Then we're just going to reverse those and say what's in update that's not in current, and those are our new items. And we're going to take those two vectors, our removed items, we're going to call our remove config function. We're going to take our new items, call our add config function, and there we go. That's all we had to do to find out what's been changed in our configuration coming in. If you wanted to write a little test that kind of showed you how that might work. So let's say this is our current config, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Here's our update, 1, 3, 4, 6, 7. So 2's not there anymore. 5's not there anymore, but we've added a 6 and a 7. So here's the code we just looked at. And here's our output, removed 5 and 2, added 7 and 6. Because it's ordered, they're not in the same order there because I sorted them. Coming soon to a compiler near you, parallel algorithms. These are experimental. You can see that they're in the experimental namespace. They're controlled by the new execution policy stuff. But what they do is they allow you to say, like, do a parallel sort or a parallel partition or that sort of thing. If you want to use multiple threads to leverage these expensive operations and make them faster, play with it. It's pretty cool stuff. So a quick review. Be familiar with all the varied algorithms. I mean, we touched like probably a quarter of the algorithms. They're all there. Write some code that exercises these things. As you can see, the code's pretty easy to do. But writing the code gets you familiar with all the personalities of these different algorithms, because they're all a little different. Like, foreach passes an object from element to element, whereas accumulate just passes a value from object to object. But otherwise, they're kind of similar. Write your own adaptations, like we did with Sean's stuff, where we wrote some new wrappers around them, or some of the stuff we did with the HTTP header stuff, where we wrote some adaptations. Implement your own algorithms. As Sean Parent says, write a paper, get published, become famous. So a quick review. I won't zip through these very slowly because we're actually over our time now, but there's a bunch there that we didn't even touch. And so play with them, see what there is. Shout out to my sponsor, F5. Come visit us if you want a job. We'd love to have experienced programmers. And we do some pretty cool technical work. And my shameless advertising, I am slowly working on putting this material and more into a book form. If you have much better examples than mine, which is not hard to do, let me know. Maybe I could throw them in there. But you can reach me there. And that's all we have. Thank you.